Welcome to Reimagining Atlantis. My name's Tori, and I'll be your host.
Gerete. Hello, my friends. Phew. I have been a busy bee these last couple of months, and I haven't had the time to research like I normally do. I had one person in my family graduate from Navy boot camp, where I had to fly to Chicago. I'm a little sad because even though I went to Chicago and I'm always on the search for the best pizza, I never managed to find the time to get an authentic Chicago deep dish. For all you Chicagoans out there, I'm sorry. I even did the research. Then, a couple weeks later, I flew out to Rock Springs, Wyoming, as someone else in the family decided that they needed to get married. Even though I had paid Wi-Fi for the flight, I didn't have any real access to the internet. My trip to Rock Springs, Wyoming was interesting. I've never been to the desert before. I've lived in two places that were always close to the sea. I could actually feel the anxiety starting to rise up in me, like, where's the ocean? Instead, I was surrounded by sand and rocks that just protruded from nowhere. There were a seemingly lack of trees, and I'm pretty sure that the desert was taking the moisture out of my veins while I slept. I'm sure for those of you who live there, you can find your unique charm. I need to be by the sea. The good news is that with my lack of internet on the plane, I had some PDFs that I had already downloaded on my phone on some scientific journals that I like to read for fun. I know I have a penchant for pain. Sometimes the journals are silly, others I find good nuggets of information. My brain often itches at Herodotus' account of the Atlantes and how there were springs with salt piles. Often, when I have this nagging itch, there's more of a story to be told. I really should prioritize reading these journals. I forget how much random information I get from them. In this episode, we embark on a journey to unravel the enigma surrounding the lost city of Atlantis, drawing from references such as Pausanias and Herodotus. We will explore the intriguing connections between the Nasamonians, whom Herodotus calls the Atlantes, and Plato's Atlantis. Could these Atlantes truly be the inhabitants of a fabled city? Libyan people living close to Mount Atlas, who lived off of wild vines and were associated with the Lyxos River. This leads us to contemplate the possibility of Atlantis being situated in a river delta, rather than on an island, as suggested by the thought-provoking scientific journal authored by Olaf Richer. Further evidence emerges with the discovery of Tamanrasset River, an ancient waterway that could have facilitated human migration across West Africa. We'll ponder the idea of this river having a delta near the Atlantic Ocean, particularly in the Bay of Arguin. Join me as we deep dive into the mysteries of Atlantis, examining historical accounts, geographical data, and scientific theories. This episode offers a captivating exploration of Atlantis's potential location and sheds light on the enduring allure of this mythical city. My sources, as always, are linked in my episode description. Ever since I worked on the episode on the Atlantic Sea, I ran across a paragraph that sparked my interest. I have let my brain mull over it enough to bring an incomplete thought to an episode. Here's the paragraph in question. Quote, "There are other Ethiopians who are neighbors of the Morai, or Mauritania, and extend as far as the Nasamonis. For the Nasamonis, whom Herodotus calls the Atlantes, and those who profess to know the measurements of the earth, named the Lyxitae, are the Libyans, who live the farthest, close to Mount Atlas, and they do not till the ground at all, but live on wild vines. But neither these Ethiopians nor yet the Nasamonis have any river. For the water near Atlas, which provides a beginning to three streams, does not make any of the streams a river, as the sand swallows it all up at once. So the Ethiopians dwell near no river ocean. That was Pausanias. The most obvious that struck me was this, quote, for the Nasamonis, whom Herodotus calls the Atlantes. While it isn't widely accepted that Herodotus' Atlantes are the people of Plato's Atlantis, I personally think it is. Plus, Plato has a few spelling mistakes that could be from Plato himself or from the translator. I won't know for sure until I finish learning ancient Greek. So let's go under the assumption that Plato was a bad speller. I think we should have a refresher on Herodotus' Atlantes. Quote, after another 10 days' journey, there is again a hill of salt, and water, and men living there. Near to this salt is a mountain called Atlas, whose shape is slender and conical, cone-shaped, and it is said to be so high that its heights cannot be seen, for clouds are always on them winter and summer. The people of the country call it the Pillar of Heaven. These men get their name, which is Atlantes, from this mountain. It is said that they eat no living creature and see no dreams in their sleep. Pliny the Elder expands upon this more. The Nasamonis, who were centered in the oases of Agula and Siwa in the Libyan desert, they used war chariots. Like the Garamantes, they were known to attack the Greek colonies in Cyrenaica. Pause real quick. Cyrenaica is actually located in Northwest Africa. It is located near modern-day Benghazi. That's been on the news a lot lately. And for those who may not know where that is, it looks like it's a little bit west of Egypt towards the Mediterranean Sea. Back to the story. During the Peloponnesian War, the citizens of Euryspades received aid from the Spartan general Glappus, who helped defend the town from the Nasamonis on his way to Sicily. Finally, that last paragraph also talks about the Lixitae. I found the following from Open Journals, and I've linked it in the episode description. Quote, those who profess to know the measurements of the earth, named the Lixitae, are the Libyans, who live the furthest close to Mount Atlas, and they do not till the ground at all, but live on wild vines. The Lixitae are located along the Lixos, also known as Leucos, and it's a sizable river that is mentioned in the Trip of Hannon. But there's no mention of a city which is located close to Larache. This is also a place close to the Garden of Hesperides, or what is believed to be the Garden of the Hesperides in modern-day Lixos. They graze their herds as nomads. In the mountains, where the river rises, above them live the inhospitable Ethiopians. Since they were held to be able to understand the Ethiopians we anticipated from Homer in the Odyssey, to meet from the east to the west of the southern edge of that inhabited world. It is likely why Hannon chose the interpreters he needed from those blocks before continuing on his navigation to the south. Now, the Lixitae hold a very similar name to Lixos. Here's Pliny the Elder's natural history. Quote, on the Atlantic coast of Africa is the river Lixos, about which the most marvelous legends are told by old writers. This was the site of the palace of Antaeus and the scene of his combat with Heracles, and here were the Garden of the Hesperides. As a matter of fact, an arm of the sea stretches inland here, with a winding channel, which, as the people nowadays explain in the story, had some resemblance to the guardian Drachon, or the dragon serpent. It embraces within it an island. On the island, there also rises an altar to Heracles. But of the famous grove in the story that bore the golden fruit, nothing else except some wild olive trees. I often mull over Herodotus on his account of the Atlantes, and specifically the salt piles. I always think, hey, that should have some sort of remnants. Like, I should be able to find it. Do you, my friends, know where these salt piles are? I'd be extremely interested. There's going to be something interesting that gets brought up about salt piles in general in the scientific journal that I'm going to read to you. So let's keep that in the back of your head for a bit. If you recall, I have proposed that there was a lake somewhere near Atlas Mountains, and that the entry canal to the Atlantic City was destroyed during the earthquake. Perhaps it was wrong, and it was a river instead. I read a lot of scientific journals for fun. Yes, I know, I'm a bit masochistic. One of these journals, which I linked in my episode description, is authored by Olaf Richter, and its title is, quote, "Plato's Atlantis was in a river delta." Before I begin with the quotes, I thought some fun facts would be needed to complete the picture. A river delta is a landform that forms at the mouth of a river where it meets a body of water, such as an ocean, sea, or lake. It is created when a river carries sediment like sand, silt, and clay and deposits it at its mouth. As the river flows into a larger body of water, its velocity slows down and that sediment it carries begins to settle. That settlement is gradually deposited and builds up over time, forming a triangular shape, or fan-shaped area, of land known as a delta. They get the name delta as it's modeled after the Greek letter D, or delta, that is known to be seen as a triangle. Hopefully the article just grabbed your attention too, so here are some fun quotes from the paper that sparked my interest. Quote, "A regular level plain surrounded on all sides by a ring canal and covered by a grid of smaller canals for irrigation and draining can only mean an alluvial plain. Either it must have been a big lagoon, which was filled with washed up matter, or, most probably, it was the delta of a great river. When looking at an atlas, one will find that such large and even plains exist only in the delta regions of great rivers, and were formed by sedimentation from these rivers over thousands or millions of years. This idea is further confirmed by the fact that after Atlantis was flooded, the resulting mud was a hindrance to ship traffic." Unquote. A little Google on the word alluvial gives me the following definition. Alluvium is loose clay, silt, sand, or gravel that has been deposited by running water in a stream bed, on a floodplain, or an alluvial fan, or beach, or in similar settings. Anyway, let's continue on with this article. Quote, "A great river. And there is mention of rivers that flow from the mountains in Critias must be fed from a large area. One must therefore contradict those who say that Atlantis was only slightly larger than that of the plain itself. If we were an island, it would have been 10 times bigger than the plain, if not more. An alluvial plain, the soil would have been very rich and fertile, as it is described in Critias. Plato described the plain as rectangular in Critias, but a perfect rectangular plain surrounded by mountain chains on three sides exists nowhere on the globe. It seems that Plato, who never saw the site himself, imagined from Solon's description that the whole plain was rectangular, and therefore calculated the consequent length of the circumferential canal to be 2 times 3,000 plus 2 times 2,000 for the four sides equaling 10,000 stades. That's from Critias. But in some translations of Critias, is not spoken of a, quote, rectangular shape, as Bury and Lee write, but of an oblong shape, as Jewlett, or of an oblong triangular shape, In Critias, we read that the plain was a rectilinear for the most part. That can mean that only a great part of the plain was rectangular and enclosed by the circumferential canal, but not all. And when Plato says in Critias that the plain measured to 3,000 stades in the length of its midpoint 2,000 stades in breadth from the coast, then this seems to be that description of the normal delta form of the plain, namely 2,000 stades wide from the sea only in the middle and smaller towards both ends. He continues on with the comparisons with the Rishat structure, but admits that it is too big, too elevated, and too far from the ocean. But he had this little nugget in this journal. Quote, salt domes can be found frequently when internal tectonic forces press on salt layers, which behave plasticically under high pressure, and therefore moves upwards along an existing crack, thus shaping the overlaying sediment layers into a, quote, dome. The erosion of the sediment dome may be accelerated relative to its surroundings due to the many cracks formed during the uplifting and reshaping process. Do you remember me pointing out that salt pile and spring in Herodotus' account? Anyway, hold on to that. Let's continue reading. Quote, formation of a salt dome and subsequent erosion of the previously reshaped alternating harder and softer sediment layers, by this process, three circular water canals were created. On top of water impermeable layers, groundwater from far distant mountains is led to the, quote, dome. The cracks bring it to the surface as springs. But in the case of Atlantis, the overlaying silt from the deluge may have hidden the ring of structures under the surface. The antique Greek city of Hylike, destroyed by a great flood in Plato's times, was found just recently under a layer of 4 to 15 meters of silt. Detection would only be possible if it were on land now, by the use of magnetometer equipment. Back to the canal between the outermost water rings and the sea. According to Critias, it was 3 plethora in breadth and 1 plethron in depth and 50 stades in length. It had the same depth as the circumferential canal around the whole plain in Critias, which was 1 stadion wide. The length of 1 Greek stadion was dependent on the time and region, between 165 meters and 213 meters. The most used value being 185 meters. 1 stadion contained 6 plethora or 600 feet. These figures for length and breadth may be reasonable, but a canal depth of 1 plethron equals 100 feet, which equals 30.8 meters, seems not credible. We must remember the canal had to be dug into an alluvial plain near the sea. In the wet soil, the canal flanks would have slipped down continuously. A canal dug in the soil cannot have vertical sides. This observation was already made by the Persian king Xerxes in 1480 BC, described by Herodotus, during the digging of the canal in northern Greece. Quote, I will now describe how the canal was cut. A line was drawn across the isthmus from Sane, and the ground divided into sections for the men of various nationalities to work on. When the trench reached a certain depth, the laborers at the bottom carried on with the digging and passed the soil up to the others above them, who stood on ladders, and passed it on to another lot, still higher up until it reached the men at the top, who carried it all the way and dumped it. Most of the men engaged in the work made the cutting the same width at the top as it was intended to be at the bottom, with the inevitable result that the sides kept falling in, and so doubled their labor. Indeed, they all made the same mistake except for the Phoenicians, who, in this, as in all practical matters, gave a signal example of their skill. They, in the section allotted to them, took out a trench double the width prescribed for the actual finished canal, and by digging at a slope, gradually contracted it as they got further down, until at the bottom, their section was the same as with the rest. So Xerxes Canal, which was found again in 1991 through 2001 by British Greek team with geophysical survey methods, was 35 meters wide to let in 2 battleships to pass, but only 4 meters in depth. It now lives under 15 meters of thick alluvial layer. Not until 10 years ago, in 1995, was it possible with modern excavators to make the Panama Canal, 1.5 meters deeper. Each meter more of depth increases tremendously the difficulties for the engineers, especially if the soil is alluvial. And the Atlanteans were supposed to have dug canals more than twice as deep as the modern Panama Canal. Moreover, the circumferential canal round the plain, 1,850 kilometers long, would have been nearly 23 times the length of the Panama Canal. This is indeed unbelievable, even if the Atlanteans had our technology instead of the technology of their age. This would be the time of horse-driven chariots, of stone shooters, and slingers. Plato was right when he doubted this information, as described in Critias. But he knew nothing about the construction of canals, and therefore did not know that the reported dimensions were not incredible, but impossible from the technical point of view. What about the opinion of some authors that all the high mountains sunk completely under the sea level during the destruction of Atlantis without remainder? It is disproved by the statement in Timaeus that, quote, Atlantis in like manner was swallowed up by the sea and vanished. Wherefore also the ocean at that spot has now become impassable and insearchable, being blocked up by shoal of mud, which the island created as it settled down. The reported portentous earthquakes and floods from Timaeus, greater than the tsunami of December 26th in 2004 in Indonesia, where it flooded the royal city together with the whole plain, leaving behind a shallow sea region where the plain had sunken for some meters. But the mountains could not sink during the catastrophe. Like this, more than the same number of meters, they must still exist today. There is a data set called the Simulated Topological Network, or STN-30P, for short, believe it or not, that helps scientists study how water flows in rivers around the world. It gives the scientists a big picture view of the rivers on the Earth. The data set shows how different parts of land are connected to each other and which direction the water would flow in those areas. It divides the land into grid cells and assigns one of 8 possible flow directions: east, southeast, south, southwest, west, northwest, north, and northeast to each cell. It's important to note that the data set represents the potential flow of water, even if there are no actual rivers in some areas. Think of it as a map of rivers that would exist if there was enough rainfall to create rivers everywhere. This data set is part of a bigger project called the International Satellite Land Surface Climatology Project Initiative, or ISLSCP2 for short. It reminds me a bit of the Strategic Homeland Intervention Enforcement and Logistics Division, or SHIELD for short. For those of you who didn't get that joke, it was a Marvel reference. Anyway, they collected data from different sources and created a set of 50 global data sets covering the period from 1986 to 1995. The purpose of this project is to help scientists understand how carbon, water, and energy cycle around the world. The purpose of this project is to help scientists understand how carbon, water, and energy cycle around the world. The data and documentation have been reviewed by experts in the field. The ISLSCP project is part of a larger initiative called the Global Energy and Water Cycle Experiment, or GEWEX, which focuses on studying interactions between the land and the atmosphere. They look at things like how land and the atmosphere could affect each other, and they use models and data to learn more about these processes. With all this talk about rivers, this seems like the perfect time to introduce to you the Tamanrasset River. It was a vast river that is said to have traversed West Africa as recently as 5,000 years ago. Granted, this is 1,000 years after the proposed Atlantean-Athenian War. The river started in the southern Atlas Mountains and Hoggar Highlands in what is now Algeria. The river eventually reached Cap Tamaris Canyon, which is deep underwater off the coast of Mauritania. The canyon is wide and goes as deep as 3 kilometers in some places. The presence of this ancient river had a big impact on human migration. It provided a pathway for people to travel from Central Africa to the Middle East, Europe, and Asia. Before they discovered this river, people thought that the Sahara made it impossible to go westwards towards Europe. But now they know that this river opened up new possibilities for migration. Scientists think that the river became active during a period of time called the African Humid Period. This period was caused by changes in the Earth's rotation, which affected the climate. The river was discovered using a special satellite system that can see beneath the sandy surface of the Sahara. It detected the remains of the river and the water that's still there. Some people believe that this ancient river may have supported a civilization in the Sahara similar to other civilizations that developed around rivers. However, there's no evidence yet to confirm this theory. Scientists only confirmed the existence of the Tamaroset River in 2015, even though an expedition searching for oil had found the Cap Tamaris Canyon in 2003, which was likely formed by the flow of water from this river system. According to Herodotus, he believed that the Nile River flowed from west to east. In his work called The Histories, Herodotus describes the Nile as flowing from the western parts of Africa, particularly from a region called the Mountains of the Moon, or modern-day Rwenzori Mountains. He believed that the river traveled in a straight line, crossing the entire continent until it reached the eastern shores of Egypt and flowed into the Mediterranean Sea. If the Tamaroset River started in the Hoggar Highlands by Algeria, then it is just as possible that it let out and had a delta by the Atlantic Ocean by the Bay of Arguin. The Bay of Arguin is a place located south of Cap Blanc and north of Cap Tamaris. It has 3 islands called Arguin and Tidra, and there are also many sandbanks in the bay. The bay is home to a big national park called Blanc d'Arguin National Park, which covers an area of 12,000 square kilometers. And this, friends, is one of my 3 main locations for the theory of Atlantic City, Atlantis.
Thank you so much for continuing to listen. Your support means everything to me. If you want to help make this podcast grow, please subscribe and tell just one other person about this podcast today. We are each our own hero in this story we call life. That means one person has the power to change everything. Who is the one person you tell today, hero? Let's help keep Atlantis alive, or at least reimagined. A new episode will be released every Thursday at 9 p.m. See you then.